Yeah, so Meetup, you should have some kind of an overview talk, and this morning, Thorsten told me there was nobody else, so I put together a couple of things in my seminar, so it's not supposed to be any particular organization to this. I just want to sort of indicate some topics that I find interesting, and so as I go through transparencies that I have, I will not be spending too much time on any particular topic. The idea is more to introduce a problem that I guess most of you are familiar with, or some of you may go from one side and not from the other side, but not to go into too much detail, that's one of them. And roughly what I wanted to mention is an introduction to the Casimir force, which is due to quantum fluctuations, thermal analog of that, some examples from soft matter, and then focus on the effects of geometry in connection with corrugated surfaces, talk a little bit about dynamic phenomena, and a couple of other geometries, cylinder plate, discussion of potential repulsive forces, and some new approach to this compact objects that we have. So, I guess we can skip most of this, except that I will mention that I will kind of indicate dimensional analysis as much as possible. So, the idea would be that if you have a geometry such as this, just from dimensional analysis, we say that the quantum electrodynamic contribution to force should be proportional to h bar, because that causes the fluctuations. It is due to electromagnetic field which travels at speed c, so you have to have h bar c. It has to be extensive and proportional to area. H bar c times area has dimensions of force times length to the fourth power. So the only length that you have to make it correctly have dimensions of force should be h to the fourth. So basically, this kind of dimensional argument should at least give us some idea in most cases, and it's a useful tool and check. And of course, one can have much more sophisticated approaches, including Lipschitz theory, that depends on all properties of the material that is constant, etc. And of course, one of the motivations for having this workshop is that within the past 10 years now, it is possible to make measurements of Casimir forces at sufficiently high precision that we can have comparisons between theory and experiment, and I guess this was started by the work of Lamoureux, and we won't have Lamoureux, as far as I understand, the postdoc from this group to come and talk to us about the most recent results. Umar Mohyeddin from Riverside will be visiting and will talk to us about their results. From the group of Capasso, we will have actually Capasso himself, and Chan will be visiting and talking to us about the various applications that they have in mind, devices, etc.
Actually, Nokia is going to be visiting also towards the end of the program. So,
a number of people who have contributed to these experimental measurements will be passing through this workshop at various times. And I guess the challenges that one faces partly geometry, how to actually calculate the forces that one has for arbitrary shapes and geometries, and that's the aspect that I did mention and focus more during my talk. But there are a lot of other questions that are important, such as the dependence on the material properties, whether one has some impurities in the system, how to treat metals, what are the effects of finite temperature, environment, all kinds of things. So there are a lot of challenges and issues to going from the realm of theory to quantitatively explaining experiments to be able to sort of make devices, etc., and have applications. And these are some of the questions that one needs to ask. So, going from quantum fluctuations to thermal fluctuations, if rather than having the electromagnetic field, we have some other medium between our plates, then typically you are limited in terms of the interactions that are mediated by this fluid or whatever is inside to the range that correlations travel in this medium. So in order to have long-range interactions, you should go to places where the correlation length is large, and so for ordinary fluids, that happens at a critical point where one has critical opalescence. But as we also talk about the superfluids, etc., where there's a wider range to look at. And then as pointed out by Fischer and Lejeune, if one looks at the finite size contribution to the free energy that one has right at the critical point, again, free energy is driven by thermal fluctuation, so one has to have KT there. Extensivity said it should be proportional to area, and again, to make it dimensionless, we have to divide by 2 powers of length, and the only length is h squared. So this is the challenge is, of course, in calculating this number, but again, from dimensional grounds, this is sort of the correct dependence on the various parameters that one has. And I guess we will have some discussion about this parameter, maybe the talk that we have tomorrow from Josephine DeCue, and there will be some other participants who will be talking about these things. And as I said, in addition to the critical point of the fluid-gas mixture, where the correlation length is infinite, for something like helium, one has other places where correlation then diverges. There's the critical point, which is where fluid becomes superfluid, and so one has infinite correlation lengths over here, and so this is actually a very good point to test the theories of Fischer and Lejeune and all the subsequent theories about the finite size effects of criticality. But furthermore, once one is within the superfluid phase, again in the superfluid phase, you have phonons that essentially travel without any characteristic length. And so all throughout the superfluid, because of the correlated fluctuations of the superfluid order parameter, you have the possibility to convert these phonons, if they are thermally fluctuating, an interaction for a finite size film that again on dimensional grounds should be proportional to KT area over h squared, and the number, since it's a Gaussian theory, is easily calculable. And we will have later in the workshop both Moses Chan and Rafael Garcia, who can come and tell us more about their original experiment that was 1999, but some of the work that they have done since then, where they measured the effects of these Casimir-type forces by looking at the thickness of a film of helium that is absorbed on a copper plate. And so this is the geometry of the helium film that comes from the liquid and covers and wets this copper plate. And its thickness is a competition in the cost of moving against gravity. So there's that chemical potential difference times the thickness of the film. And the gain is because of van der Waals. And whatever other interactions, including Casimir forces that you have, they both fall off as one over thickness squared. And if you balance these two, you will find that the thickness of the film is going to be mediated by these forces, including any contribution due to fluctuations that we discussed that you would have in this film over here. And so the fluctuations that are taking place here, because of finite size effects, we determine the thickness. And then when they measure the thickness, going very close, again, this is a scale that is in temperature very close to the lambda point, and indeed, right below the lambda point, there is a decrease in the thickness, and then the thickness does not go all the way back, but comes up to some finite amount shorter, and so then presumably all of this thing occurring within a fraction of a degree away from the lambda point has to be due to superfluid fluctuations. Called Van der Waals, Hamilton constants, etc., are not going to really considerably over this range. And so the question is, how does one explain this? Let's forget about the critical aspects and just focus on what is happening below in the superfluid phase, where there is this amount of change in thickness. And if we go and look only at the contribution from these columns that I mentioned, one finds that the change in thickness should be what is indicated by this dashed line. So the fact that there is more change in thickness indicates that in addition to the phonons of the superfluid, there are additional degrees of freedom. And so with Royer, Zandi, and Jurodnik, we suggested that maybe it is due to the capillary modes, the fluctuations that one has on the surface of the film that is vibrating. And when we include the effect of those fluctuations, we find another contribution to the force, which again is something that will not be present once you are in the normal fluid, but once you are in the superfluid and you have this coupling between the phase of the orbit parameter and the velocity of the fluid, you suddenly come about, and the sum total of the phonon and the capillary mode contributions are sufficient to sort of account for this change in thickness. So this really just describes when you are away from the critical point and you have Gaussian theories to deal with, of course explaining exactly what is going on at the transition itself, one has to deal with the critical theory that is there, and we made an attempt to do that by the field analysis, but there has been some further work that uses more sophisticated methods, and one can sort of qualitatively explain this behavior, but my feeling is that in order to quantitatively understand it, one has to sort of better take into account the boundary conditions, the fluctuations of the capillary mode, etc. So that's one set of questions that one can deal with that have to do with critical Casimir forces, wetting, etc. But one has other examples in soft matter. Luca Felitti, who's another participant in the workshop, many years ago suggested that liquid crystals would be a good example to look for fluctuation in these forces, because again, once you are within a liquid crystal, you have a fluid type of system, but this fluid has orientation and some other correlations that persist over long distances. So this is again another example of a system that has an infinite correlation length. And there is some theory for the analog of photons that one has in the pneumatic liquid crystal, for example, in terms of the fluctuations of the orientation of the rod-like molecules. And one can compute the corresponding fluctuation-induced force if there is a slab. And again, dimensionally, it is area over x squared. But then the correction, the coefficient that one has here is no longer just a single universal number, but does depend on ratios of these elastic constants that appear in this material. So far, I think what was interesting was that we never had any material dependent parameter for description of Casimir forces to lowest order, but here in the pneumatic liquid crystals, it does depend on elastic constants. An extreme example of a pneumatic is when there's also a layering that takes place and you make a transition to what is called a symmetric liquid crystal, in which case the theory is no longer isotropic in the two directions. In one direction it's derivative squared, in the other direction it's the second derivative squared. And for this kind of theory, actually, the nature of the force changes rather than the area over h squared, this area over h, because there is another length scale that we can construct in this problem by comparing the ratio of these two constants. So in principle, if one could measure these forces in symmetric liquid crystals, they would be almost.
So here the z direction is the direction of is parallel to the layers.
The z direction is
perpendicular.
And the xy direction.
And is there an interesting change if you do the other way around?
I don't remember. This is something that we did long time ago. Here you can see that the second derivative is because in this direction it is like bending. And as to what we did was your problem. My guess is that the power losses.
Okay. Might be that the power loss is
okay. Now I will come back to this, but I think all of these things have kind of remained from 1991 in the realm of theoretical constructs. And the reason for that is partly kind of coupled to the answer to your question, which is that as soon as one introduces boundaries in liquid crystals, at the boundaries, there is some kind of an effective field that tends to orient the layers in some particular direction or orient the molecules in some particular direction. And so as soon as that happens, one sort of sets up some kind of an elastic gradient in the material. And so the leading contribution that one has once one has boundaries and liquid crystals comes not from these terms, but from the direct bending, etc., that one has for the materials. So in the analogous thing for Casimir effect, it would be like having charged plates as opposed to neutral plates, and then the direct Coulomb interaction would overwhelm anything from fluctuations. So from 1991, there are all of these calculations that one can do, but I can't point to a particular experimental example that is able to avoid the direct elastic cost that one is trying to produce.
There are some very nice measurements for lipid multilayers near surfaces. Mm-hmm. The poor lipid has to decide. He sits near the surface,
yes,
stops being able to bend, and then gradually learns how to bend.
Yes.
Or it just lifts off the whole stack and leaves an extra piece near the surface, and okay, so it can enjoy all the undulations. Uh-huh. So there's some very nice problems in that.
But something that maybe has some chance, I think I mentioned this in one of our discussions, is that if one has a liquid of polymers, and you have inclusions between them, this is something that Sergei Obukhov has been talking about for a long time, and more recently published, then there is repulsive Casimir forces. Again, because in polymer solutions, you have very long polymers. And then the fact that it is a very long thing ultimately implies that if you make an adjustment on one side, there is some information that will go to the other side. You want to make that more quantum.
Also, a variation of this would be pneumatic polymer solutions. I mean, with stiff polymers, of course, you can create a pneumatic polymer,
yes,
phase, and then that would be a little bit similar to the smectic case, actually.
Why?
If you imagine a two-dimensional system of polymers, it's
right.
It would be a similar kind of thing. If you look at the three elastic terms, except for pneumatic polymers, there's no splay term because it's forbidden, since you have coupling between density and fluctuations.
So I guess the overall message is that one can sort of think about a variety of cases where there is a fluid where there are long-range correlations because of something. There is some kind of an order that you establish. I guess the superfluid is the simplest example. You have the superfluid order parameter and the phase, but then there are all of these other cases that one can postulate. And I think to me, again, the big question is there a good experimental example that one can find? So the theory is nice, but can you find an experimental example? One case where there is certainly some experimental example is when one has charged fluids. We tried, but there was no battery. And so here are some interesting systems, kind of some version of quantum electrodynamics, because these things are interacting by Coulomb interactions. But really, there's lots of thermal fluctuation, which is the reason that the counter ions sort of move away from the charged macro ions and go in fluctuation solution. And then there are several examples of these cases where you have macro ions. Where on these grounds you would expect that you have two charged objects in turn, but effectively because of the fluctuations of the counter ions, there's some attractive contribution, and say DNA with the multivalent counter ions is supposed to be an example. Okay. But I mean, you agree that they bundle up to each other, but you say that the reason that they do may not be counter ion fluctuations. Okay. But one can also do this with two charged plates and look at deviations that one has to GUI Chapman and other kinds of approaches. Okay. So the other type of examples, and I guess we had a couple of people, I guess most people don't show up in the morning, working on membranes. And so the idea is that if you have inclusions on a membrane, again, the natural undulation of the membrane has to be damped out where you have these undulation in these inclusions, and because of that there is going to be some kind of fluctuation induced component to that reaction that again dimensional grounds as a function of the separation are it is going to be proportional to the product of the two areas and will fall off as 1 over r to the fourth, which again, because it's two-dimensionally mediated, you would say it is stronger than the van der Waals type of interaction that is three-dimensionally mediated. But once more, again, I think most of the cases, as soon as you put in two proteins or whatever in the membrane, you cause elastic distortions and changes, etc., that are long-range, that are going to be overwhelming these fluctuation-induced components. So for this, I also don't know a very good experimental example. Yes?
So you want to put in something heavy so that the membrane doesn't fluctuate at that point?
Yeah, so basically, the theory that describes the membrane is this Laplacian of H squared. So imagine, theoretically, that you put in some kind of a metal plate or something that doesn't bend. So the boundary conditions that you have is that over this area, the deformation is simply something like a constant plus a linear part. So if I were to sort of look at the distortion, it is going to be like this. Here it will go like this, and then like this. So you impose those boundary conditions, and you compute, and you get this correction to the free energy. Okay. And I guess at some point we decided to see what happens if rather than having things that were kind of circular, one has extended objects, and then one can sort of worry about the orientation dependence. And this is a theme that will come up again and again, is that if you compute the dependence on the orientations, you will get a result that is different from taking interactions that are of this form, that are between kind of shapeless objects, and assuming that the interaction between these two rods can be obtained by adding pairwise interactions that you would have between, say, one shapeless object here and all shapeless objects here, and integrating that, you would get a totally different orientation dependence. Okay, so.
Just briefly, that was actually confusing, at least to me.
Say that again. Okay, so suppose you've calculated the interactions between two spheres or two squares or two shapeless objects as a function of separation. Now, a naive calculation for extended object would be that, okay, this element has that attraction to here, to here, to here, to here, so I'm going to integrate that against all of this, integrate that against, so I do two integrations of the previous type of force, and because of the separations depend on that two angles, doing that you will get some orientation dependence. But the orientation dependence that you would get by that calculation is very different from the result of the actual calculation.
Even the asymptotic limit where R is larger than L?
That's actually the limit that we calculated. I guess the important thing is that these epsilons should be much less than L. So clearly, if you go in the limit, so that because of the picture, it should really be actually much further separated. It's the R large limit. But then the point is that if epsilon and L of the same order, they're kind of like shapeless objects, but if epsilon and L, epsilon is much less than L, so it's an extended object, then it's a different dependence. They are both inclusions in the membrane, and the assumption is that any the fluctuations that you are going to look at, they're kind of, you have undulations, all kinds of shapes that are allowed. Once you hit the boundary within these elements, you are only allowed to go with a particular slope. So imagine that you have some kind of a ruler, and the ruler is not allowed to deform, then it's placed on the membrane. So that's the boundary conditions.
So you also have,
but they are on the same plane or they are in different planes?
Oh, well, they are in the same membrane, which on average is parallel, let's say, to. So the base configuration around which I am allowing fluctuations is flat surface, yes.
But they can themselves fluctuate.
They can themselves fluctuate along with the membrane, right? So basically, if I didn't have these rods, the membrane would be fluctuating according to Laplacian of H squared theory, which allows huge fluctuations. The presence of these, since they are stiff objects, you put this ruler down, it reduces fluctuations the whole place. And then you put two of them, if they are closer to each other and appropriately oriented, their reduction that is joint is going to be less than the sum total of the two reduction, and so there's some kind of effective attraction between them because of this fluctuation.
So which difference would it be if you made the boundary condition the a condition on the derivative of the of derivative phase. So the tangent vector at the surface.
Okay. What kind of boundary conditions you are possible to allow depends on the theory. So the theory that we worked out was partly this bending energy, and then the two, you need to impose two boundary conditions. That is, at when these things are joined, they come together with the same height and with the same slope. If you have surface tension rather than this, which is gradient of H square theory, then the boundary condition is just that the H, the height is the same. The derivative could be different. It turns out that actually most of the results that we obtain are independent. I mean, all of the factors, etc., will change, but the qualitative behavior is the same, whether it's surface tension driven or curvature driven.
So, because in some cases the inclusion prefers a certain angle.
Oh, okay. Now that was the question, that I, the thing that I was saying. That all of this is very nice theoretically, but then you come to the question of why hasn't anybody gone and seen these things, is because precisely what you said, that typical inclusions include modifications, let's say, in the slope. And if I want to change the slope here and the slope there, well, there is an elastic energy that I have to add on top of this. Okay, so this will still be there, but the other part will completely overwhelm this.
There were some calculations in the physics you drew.
Yes.
But for the interface between two existing phases and two colloids, and one of the cases they were considering is that the contact angle is fixed and it's just given by a property of the fluid
and the material.
Right. And they found that. They consider also the situation that the contact angle can change, the position of the interface can change, and they all give rise to different distance dependence.
Right. Changes of sign.
Yeah, but the but they were considering the interface between two coexisting spaces, so it's more like surface tension.
Yeah, so this really is part of an interesting study of how inclusions change things, but my feeling is that the fluctuation-induced component is just a small part and it probably is not that relevant. Okay? All right. So... Now, I started talking about this lack of pairwise additivity, so I'm going to sort of re-emphasize that in connection with the slight modification of the parallel plate geometry, where one has two surfaces, let's say, that are corrugated or otherwise distorted, but the simplest case is to imagine two sinusoidal corrugations, etc. And so, how would people calculate the Casimir force between two such plates? Now, there is a very common method for dealing with these situations that comes under the heading of proximity force approximation, originally introduced by Der Jagin. And it is, in some sense, correct in some particular limit, but typically it is applied by people way beyond that limit. And the idea is the following. That suppose you knew what the interaction was between two flat plates. It could be Casimir or some modification of the Casimir depending on material properties. So you know energy for the flat configuration as a function of separation H. Imagine that your surfaces are sort of lots and lots of these small elemental squares, D2X. But then when you look locally, the separation is not exactly what the average separation is, but because of the distortions H1 and H2 has been modified by a certain amount. So in the pairwise, this proximity force approximation, what you do is you basically add up all of those things. And so in some sense, if this is a small variation h of x with respect to h, you could expand your interaction, and if the interaction, let's say, falls off as 1 over separation cube, the first correction that you will have would be of this form. But in this kind of approximation, you can see that you will be kind of sensitive to the various mean squared fluctuations that you have between the two surfaces, but you will not be sensitive to how they are distributed. So you could basically have the same amount of variance using fluctuations that are either very short wavelength or very large wavelength, and within this approximation, they will give you the same answer. So if you like, this proximity force approximation is insensitive. It is sensitive to the fluctuations, but not to how closely they are spaced. And so one can go and check this. So let's say that we have specifically a fluctuation that has amplitude A and some particular wavelength lambda. And Thurston, we did some calculations on this, but let's focus on the experiment that actually was done by Roy and Mohyeddin, where they looked at a situation such as this, where they constructed a corrugated surface that had some particular amplitude and some particular wavelength, and they computed the Casimir force. And so what is plotted here is the result for the flat plate, the result that they get from the corrugated plate, and the solid line is what you would expect from this pairwise proximity force approximation. Okay, so basically the lesson from this experiment is that at least for this range of wavelengths, amplitudes, etc., that they looked at, there is a deviation from this proximity force approximation.
So give us a little intuition how big the bumps are compared to the Z, and it was crazy.
Okay, so the amplitude here is 60 nanometers. Yes, the wavelength in the experiment is 1 micron. Okay, and the range of separations here, I believe, is in 200 to 1,000 nanometers.
Right, so it's going absolutely crazy. It never works.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you where you don't expect it to fall. I'll come to that. So basically, we can do the analytical calculation, and we do the analytical calculation for small distortions, and we find that when the wavelength of the distortion is much larger than the separation, so the separation between the two plates or the distance of the closest approach, when that is the smallest distance in the problem, then the proximity force approximation works. But when you have something that is very, very wiggly or short wavelength, then the proximity force approximation doesn't work, and the correction, rather than falling off as a squared over h squared, falls off as a squared over lambda h.
Because you're getting into Deryaghan territory, is that where
you think? So this is the Deryaghan territory, yes. So the Deryaghan territory is fine. So basically, where it works, and you should be using it, is when the separation is the shortest length scale in the problem. Okay? If the wavelength of the distortion is shorter than the separation, then you can't use that. Okay. And there's a crossover function that goes between them, etc., that one can compute. Okay. And so actually a kind of hand-waving way of seeing why you go from the change being of the order of 1 over h squared to being 1 over, rather than being proportional to a squared, being proportional. Well, never mind. I mean, I'm going to confuse you if I were to discuss this. But basically, you would imagine that if this wavelength is very, very small, so that this becomes like a comb, okay? So if I have something like a comb, what you would be measuring is not the distance to the middle, but you would be measuring the distance to the top, right? And so then you can see that when the wavelength is very small, your effective distance, rather than being h, is h minus a. And so the corrections are going to be of the order of a over h rather than a squared over h squared. You don't have this symmetry. Okay? And so now it turns out that our perturbative calculation also relies on a being very small, a being smaller than lambda. And so these results are actually not directly comparable to the range that they did the experiment, but they show you why qualitatively there is this failure of the pairwise approximation. And Thurston has been able to sort of develop more sophisticated numerical means of computing the forces in this geometry that don't rely on this perturbative approximation that we used initially.
Mehran,
yes.
In the experiment, you just take h minus a. Doesn't that fit more or less?
In the experiments, if you were to replace z with z minus whatever this amplitude is, I'm pretty sure that they tried that and it doesn't. I mean, certainly it won't work the whole range.
And then you would expect to work actually in the limit where this wavelength is
very
smallest scale.
Yeah.
So that you really have this kind of comp geometry.
Yeah.
So they, can I hear you say, so when the wavelength is very small, it all goes over to being almost like a continuum again, like a spongy average material. If the wavelength is very small,
yes.
So you can treat it as quasi-homogeneous.
Yeah.
Is this all Casimir or Lipschitz? I mean, do we have any soft boundary conditions?
This is gold-plated aluminum. It's supposed to be
so
Casimir.
It's Casimir.
Yeah.
If you would have a Lipschitz situation with dielectrics, I guess the corrugated layer you could just treat as another layer on Lipschitz with some effective epsilon.
Again, I think once you get to question of length scales becomes important. So I think that would be correct as long as your separation, I mean, separation is really the length scale by which you are viewing your object. Okay, and so this. I think the lesson is that if the separation is small, that you are seeing some details, then you can't ignore them.
So if separation is small, you go back to proximity force of the Riemannian, right?
If the very, very small, so that the main contribution comes from the top here to
right.
There, yeah.
The Riemannian.
Then there is another,
and
yeah.
At very large separations, it would be kind of Lipschitz with an additional layer
yes.
With mixed epsilon.
Yeah.
And in between, you say it's very complicated.
That's right. Now, there was also some question about how accurate these experiments are because they didn't really use plate, they used the sphere. And so the question of exactly where the sphere is located with respect to the phase of the sinusoidal is important, and whether or not it is allowed to shift during this measurement causes complications also.
Maybe one should mention that there's a very recent experiment on a very similar geometry by Hobon Chan from Florida. So he looks basically at that geometry, but in a range where the amplitude of the corrugations are much bigger as compared to the separation, and he looks at a kind of a square wave corrugation. And so he has very precise technique to measure this force. And he actually compared the results to to our non-perturbative calculations, which are for perfect metals. And here is, of course, not a perfect metal, but I think he does it for gold and okay, I have to check. Let's see. For silicon. And so there is some difference, but this general tendency on how the force depends on the geometry is reproduced. Agrees in the experimental data, they agree with what we predicted theoretically.
Okay.
It just came out like in PRL a couple of weeks ago.
I'm getting confused now. Level 9, level, what's going on? You gave some real materials, but you're saying the theory is from metals. I'm not sure.
Yes, yes.
So how does it agree?
Well, there's no direct agreement that in the sense that the numbers are perfectly matched, but you can plot, or if you look at the force, say as a function of the convolution wavelength of the distance, and how it changes with the different ratios of length scales here, you see that that tendency agrees with what we predicted theoretically.
Yeah.
But I mean, they in this publication there's this comparison, and maybe you should look at that and see.
Yeah.
I have a much more primitive question. Can you remind me the difference between van der Waals and Casimir? One is relativistic parallelism.
Okay, I think Adrian will write books about that, so he can. But okay, so very roughly, again, this definition depends on, I guess, who you are talking to. So let's imagine that we have two atoms or molecules. So they have some characteristic vibrational excitation, etc. And when that vibrational excitation is important, let's say it's some frequency omega zero, the interaction goes like h bar omega zero squared, h bar omega zero, and then falls off as 1 over r to the sixth as a function of their separation. So it depends on the actual nature of the molecules, and that's typically what I would call van der Waals. Now, if you were to take them very, very far apart, at some point, the internal structure and the fact that these are atoms disappears. And it is like two-point boundary conditions that you have. And then the interaction falls off as 1 over r to the seventh. And the only thing that comes in is the polarizability of the materials, which is dependent on their volume. So that's, in some sense, going from something that is called non-retarded van der Waals to something that is usually called retarded van der Waals, and I'm inclined to calling the retarded van der Waals Casimir, but maybe other people have different.
I had a horrible time answering this question for myself because I didn't know what to call my book. So traditionally, if you're focusing on vacuum fluctuations and you're idealizing the materials to be metals, that's in the Casimir tradition of thinking of black box radiation and changes in energy with geometry. Typically, the other tradition is the Landau-Lipschitz tradition of looking at the material properties as sources of fluctuations and then seeing how they propagate, whether it's in a vacuum or in other materials. So typically one is using charge fluctuation forces as the term, or sometimes Lipschitz forces, but generally it goes back to the idea of materials, and we say van der Waals, because van der Waals was really thinking about condensations, and that's the tradition in the thinking. Historically, I guess, Casimir had this really brilliant idea that the vacuum means something, and he said, if I change the shape of the vacuum, I get forces, so that's been a whole tradition of thinking. In the Russian school, it was all with Deryagin and colloids. And he was then wondering why colloidal particles are aggregating in liquids. So he was completely preoccupied with material properties all the time.
But the Hubble laws are
different. So there was one length scale that came in. So is there a factor of C and some frequency
gives me that length?
Absolutely. What Mehron is saying, if you're looking at the vacuum and how you're handling the waves, yes. One of the things that, when I was writing the book, I was shocked because it's not absolutely ever see power laws with real materials. And it's not that commonly that you even see a clean power law, because you have material properties changing the fluctuations at those same frequencies where the finite wavelength is causing these so-called retardation effects. So these all became idealized limits, as Mehron just said. Is that a fair answer?
Yeah, I think I would say that looking at fluctuations of the material and looking at the fluctuations of vacuum are dual perspectives of the same thing. So to me, that's not necessarily, I mean, sort of maybe some community is looking and explaining things in terms of something, some community in terms of another thing. If they both do it correctly, they would get the same thing. But there is a distinction in that maybe communities such as us thinking about renormalization group and what is relevant, etc., in when you are, there is a limit where the nature of the objects and the material is important, but if you separate them out, it kind of becomes irrelevant.
So more naively, can I just think that Van der Waals has some characteristic frequency?
Yeah.
Of some relevant, let's say, molecular frequency.
Right.
And it is sort of ultimately low enough that I don't have to worry about retardation and C does not enter.
Right.
Now, if I have a material with lots of very, very high frequencies, then I have to worry about the contribution of those high frequencies, and they're getting cut off by retardation. So I'm trading.
Right, but that also depends on the length scale at which.
Oh, precisely.
Yeah.
So the cutoff is coming from the length and the C, then presumably some.
So there is a characteristic.
In the UV and whatnot.
So there is a characteristic length scale below which you have to worry about properties of the material and all of these things. But beyond that material-dependent length scale, there is some more universality. And my feeling is that that regime, maybe we should call Casimir, but there's a whole community of people who have been calling different things.
If one looks at zero temperature and ignores thermal fluctuations completely, then I think that limit of where retardation is not important is just known as the London force. And then I think the idea of Casimir and Polder was to basically start to generalize the result of London to include retardation.
And indeed, as Adrian will tell you, in addition to London, there are 500 other names like Keysum and other things that are associated.
But this is okay.
But when you finally come to it, I'm amazed how easily people use the phrase zero temperature. You know, we were taught in the thermal course how hard it is to get there, and yet we're living there all the time in our minds. So.
Yes.
Jaffe wrote a paper on the duality in 2005, and so his conclusion was that actually our Casimir experiments do not tell us that you actually can state that you have vacuum fluctuations because there's a dual perspective, like you were saying. So,
you mean because you always have to have a material for kind of source.
So the only way it would actually would have told us for sure that there were vacuum fluctuations, that they would show up in gravity, but we haven't observed them. So in terms of Casimir experiments, they have a dual explanation.
Right.
So it's kind of interesting. Yeah, a good thing to look at is, can one make an experiment that would distinguish the two?
How would you specify now?
Now, can you make an experiment that would actually distinguish the two?
No, I heard that, but I'm just trying to think in terms of what would be the kinds of things that you have in such a...
Well, for example, in you have electrostatics.
Yeah.
The difference would be in electrostatics, you can explain things as the integral over the electric field squared, or you could look at it as interactions between the sources, and they're identical. But once you have the dynamic situation, then you have the production of EM waves, and that clearly distinguishes. So it's maybe the dynamical Casimir effect can maybe possibly. Make a distinction if you have the production of photons.
But I guess to sort of, you see that simple questions, Boris, lead to long discussions, and that actually is part of the reason we thought this workshop may be good, because different people who use terms such as Van der Waals or Casimir, etc., okay, they have very well-defined stakes and territories, but in reality they are all continuously connected, and so we were hoping that it would include all of these people so that they don't protect their realms so fiercely. Okay, so continuing with these corrugated plates, of course, another thing that happens if you have two of them is that there will be sideways forces that would try to bring them in registry. And so the group at UC Riverside also did experiments in which they had the corrugations on both of the two entities that they were measuring, and they could see some kind of a lateral force that had the right periodicity. But again, the question of its magnitude, etc., gets into all of these questions about the wavelength dependence, the amplitude dependence, etc., and is not trivial. But so we won't go into.
Again, how would the pairwise summation fare here? Not for the causing, of course, but let's say if you have sub-boundary conditions.
Okay, I think this is the theoretical comparison between pairwise summation and the correct result that we have for this expansion in terms of the amplitude.
And that's Casimir. Right?
That's Casimir, yes. And so there is certainly distinction between them, but my feeling is that the experimental case was not sufficiently well characterized that you would point to it as a test of failure of pairwise summation. I don't know if you want to.
I think one tries to do not pairwise summation, but the Arduino proximity force approximation to get this lateral force, that becomes completely wrong, because that would predict actually an algebraic decay of the lateral force. And we know that the lateral force decays exponentially with distance between the effects. So that gives even the wrong dependence of this force. But the pairwise summation does better.
Okay, so I guess Ariel mentioned the idea of dynamic versions of this, and so basically, rather than having flat plates, one can have deformations in time, rather than the formations in space that I was talking about. But actually, when one gets into theoretical formulations, because electrodynamics is a relativistic theory, deformations in space and deformations in time are not too different. There's potentially mappings between them, but one has to think a lot about interpretations. And so there was some work in the early 70s by Moore, Fulling, and Davis, etc., as to what happens if you try to vibrate plates, and they sort of predicted that there will be a force that is related in 1 plus 1 dimension to the third derivative, but in real three-dimensional geometry to actually the fifth derivative. So you have to go way beyond acceleration in order to see some of these effects. There are other interesting consequences of moving plates, such as radiation. So let me just skip a lot of these things. So basically, if you take one corrugated plate and start vibrating it at sufficiently high frequency, at lower frequency, it experiences some kind of a friction. So there is some kind of a restoring force that you have to put in order to even in vacuum vibrate it. And if you try to do it at sufficiently high frequency, you start emitting photons, and there is dissipation of energy, and one can sort of do some nice calculation, actually, that my former student Ramin Golestanian did, to show that there is no energy that is lost or gained. That is, the loss that you have in friction is precisely the amount that is sent out in terms of radiation. So there are proposals to use vacuum energy as generating for you cheap energy, but at least for this particular example, we couldn't find. Okay, so I guess yesterday we had this lunchtime talk about nanotubes, and I think these cylindrical geometries are very interesting as being kind of intermediate between atoms and being flat plates that are Casimir, but something that is different. And so I'm going to sort of think about at first just a cylinder and a plate, and the cylinder is characterized by some length and some radius r, and is separated the distance h from the mirror. And we are going to assume that all of these are perfect methods. Okay? But my feeling is that one should be able to get the asymptotic dependences on R, H, L, etc. Correctly. And so I'm going to sort of propose to you some possibilities as to what the dependence of, let's say, the energy, if you take one derivative, it will become force, on these parameters should be. So one possibility, again, the whole thing should be proportional to h bar c. Now, the standard Casimir-Porter interaction, let's say, between a sphere of radius r, the other picture that I had over here, and the plate, it is proportional to the volume or polarizability r cubed. So again, this is where the vibrational properties of the atom, etc., have disappeared. The only thing that is left from it is its volume of space or polarizability is proportional to that. So again, to get the powers right, it has to fall off as 1 over h to the fourth. And of course, there's experimental verification of this. And Martin just left is going to presumably tell us about more measurements of the interaction between an atom and a surface. Now, given that information, what would you expect the interaction of the cylinder and a plate would be? So for a sphere, it was proportional to its volume. So if you follow that argument, you would say that it will be proportional to r squared times the length. Okay, so that's that analogy. It's proportional to volume Lr squared, and again, it should fall off as h to the fourth. If you say that it is proportional to area, roughly you would say it's proportional to Lr, and then it should fall off as h cubed. You can do more sophisticated proximity force integrations, and the answer depends on Lr, h minus r cubed, etc. So you can see that all of these different ways of looking at this will give you different dependences on L, R, and H. So let's focus on the following question. Presumably you expect that in the limit where R goes to zero, the interaction should vanish. So let's focus on that. So according to one theory, it should vanish as r, r squared. Here, I guess we have square root of r, etc.
Oh, okay. No, I didn't realize.
So it should vanish. Now, when one does this calculation correctly, one finds that actually the dependence on r is not a power law, but appears as a log. Okay? So I think the co-dimension of the object the dimension of the object is very important. Here, when we set r going to zero, what is left is a line in space. So boundary conditions are modified along a line. Whereas when we have a sphere and r goes to zero, it becomes a point. Boundary conditions of the field are modified along a point. And you would, if you have plate and the thickness of the plate goes to zero, you are left still with a surface. And indeed, if you have a metallic surface in this idealized limit, it doesn't really matter how thick the surface is. If there is an ideal metal and R goes, the thickness of the surface goes to zero, it still will feel the entire Casimir force. So the question of what happens in the limit where some dimension of the object goes to zero is very dependent on what is left, whether what is left is a plate, a sphere, or a point, or a line. And our sort of conclusion is that in the limit where what is left is a line, I mean, and associated with lines you always have these logarithms, etc., the vanishing is according to the line. And so that immediately tells you, again, by power counting, etc., that the interaction should fall off as a function of separation as 1 over 8 squared, because it has to be extensive in the length. And so my feeling is that this is a very important test of any other calculation, etc., to take this limit. And does it get this limit right? Does it see the difference between what is left is a line as opposed to a point or a surface or not?
This is, of course, ideal method. That's what you're talking about.
That's ideal method, yes, I agree. But if there is a theory, your calculations that you were, approach that you were discussing yesterday, I mean, in principle, the approach that you were discussing yesterday had as its input epsilon parallel and epsilon perpendicular. I can put those epsilons to infinity in the formulas, and that becomes metal. So the question is, if that approach, you believe it, to what extent you believe it, does it represent? Okay. Yeah, but then my question is, where should I trust it, right?
Well, the material will tell you, because you're doing a summation of the frequencies or an integration.
Okay.
So you can ask the material, when are you still a conductor?
That question, I agree. So there's part of it which is how you are treating the object, but the other part of it is the formalism that allows you to go from the properties of the object to the properties of the extended system. And so what I'm questioning is, should I trust that formalism? Okay? Is that legitimate?
Try to do it two ways.
Okay. So basically, this is my sort of take on this. And we can actually calculate the interaction between two cylinders or cylinder and plate, not just in this limit, but at arbitrary separation. And in fact, we can do more complicated things like having two cylinders with one plate or two enclosing plates, etc. And I guess this was kind of noted by Stephen Johnson, who's coming next week from other numerical approaches, that if you look at the force between two extended cylinders, so you have, okay, these two cylinders, and you measure the force between them, and then you measure that force, but you bring it close to a surface that is also a mirror. Now, as long as you are doing things by pairwise additivity within any approximation, you would say that the horizontal force should have no contribution to this vertical distance, because by symmetry it will cancel. Right? Whatever comes from one side has some contribution from the other side. Now, what is shown here is the dependence of the horizontal force on this vertical separation, and it has actually a non-monotonic character. So this is, again, another indication of the importance of many body effects, etc., and question of how one should try to compute those things. There is this question of whether or not one can have repulsive Casimir force. And so this is somebody's idea of a device that would work if the Casimir force was repelling you from some geometry similar to the one that we discussed earlier with the corrugations. But there is really no theoretical support for this. I guess one of the origins of this argument was that if one looks at a sphere, the sign of the Casimir type finite size correction is such that you would maybe think that the two sides of the sphere are repelling each other, and that if one were to cut the sphere, the two parts would blow apart. But as Israel Klich and Kenneth have shown, there is actually a theorem that if you were to have a mirror image symmetry, which is what you would have if you were to cut the sphere in half, the two sides would actually attract each other. And so there is no indication that one can have this kind of repulsive force.
Let's the calculation of Klich, is it pairwise?
No, no. It's the complete Casimir calculation. Now, of course, they could not calculate the exact result for two semispheres. What they showed was that generally for objects with mirror plane symmetry, the sign will be attractive. Okay. And I think what Israel told me is that he's working on being able to remove that restriction of mirror symmetry, so any two objects that are separated by a plane are attracting each other, whether one can show that or not. And maybe Thorsten has some ideas on that. And I guess Thorsten mentioned our newer approach that basically for any two compact objects, we can calculate the Casimir force if one knows the result of scattering of electromagnetic field from them. And in particular, since exact results for electromagnetic scattering from spheres are available, we have the full interaction between two spheres or sphere and a plate that goes from the proximity force limit in one case where they are very close to Casimir polder when they are very far apart, and everything in between we can compute. And so I guess let me just, in view of the time, as I said, I'm not going to discuss anything in detail. I was just giving an impression. So let's sort of go over the things that I said. You said that Casimir forces in quantum electrodynamics have moved from the range of theory to experimental application. And we are going to have some presentations from the people who did the experiments, such as Namoru's group, Mohyeddin, Capasso, Onofrio, etc., who are going to tell us about the more recent developments and the challenges that face in going from less idealized theory to actual applications and experiment. He said that rather than H-bar quantum fluctuations, one can have thermal fluctuations, and the experiments of Moses Chan and Rafael Garcia provide a very nice realization of this for wetting of films. And again, even there, the interpretation of what is happening close to the critical point, I think, remains a challenge that is not completely understood. But there are also other examples in soft matter where there are correlated fluids, long-range correlations in liquid crystals, polymers, membranes, and potentially charged systems that Adrian said he doesn't like for DNA. But that sort of comes to this question of, for these cases, can
so
one
we
find
have measured the DNA and the works.
Okay. So the challenge here to me is finding a good, well-controlled experimental system. So I guess you would agree with that, even in that. And then there are the simplest cases of deformation in geometry, where one has corrugated surfaces. And the experiments of Mohyeddin showed the presence of the lateral force and deviation from pairwise summation, but not at the level where one can sort of have a very nice correspondence between theory and experiment. These are indeed for perfect metals, but I guess later on done by Chan in the case of silicon also. So there's sort of work here for both numerical analytical schemes and then better comparison with experiments. And we will hear about numerical schemes next week. I think dynamical effects where one has force and radiation from moving plates are very interesting and would provide kind of more interesting probes of friction of vacuum and radiation from uncharged bodies, etc. They're very exciting, but they're kind of further removed from experiments. Now, Onofrio has some ideas and has even started putting together some apparatus, so maybe he will tell us what is possible and what is not possible with experimental probes of dynamic effects. I said that I'm interested in the cylinder geometry, whether it's cylinder plates, multiple cylinders, etc., because of this question of dimensionality, co-dimensionality, etc., and it would be interesting to sort of find relevance and applications to nanotubes or something else. There's question of weakening these Casimir forces, which one can certainly do by introducing another medium in the system, but as long as one has only vacuum and metallic plates, what can one do? And as I said, there is some theoretical work by Israel, but it would be good to sort of have more general statements and theorems about what is possible and what is not possible. And then when one gets to compact objects and atoms, we are going to hear next week from Martin about measurements of Casimir Polder for more unusual surfaces. And I guess we have the beginnings of some general theory for dealing with compact objects in terms of their scattering properties, but then it would be good to combine our more general theory with what is available in terms of experiments, calculations about dielectric properties of matter as a function of frequencies and get a more complete picture. And so again, there have been lots of people contributing to this, and many of them we will see during this workshop. So again, this was my own overview of the various things that one has in this realm of fluctuation-induced forces.